Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Here's what you need to know about Nick Offerman. He is both extremely talented and insanely humble. Oh, and that giggle that he would sometimes let out on Parks and Recreation? That's his real laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast, and on today's episode of The Last Laugh, the man who brought Ron Swanson to life is here to share his story with you. It would have been exciting to get Nick on this podcast anytime over the past year, but I am especially thrilled that he is here now because I'm kind of obsessed with his latest show. On Devs, which is streaming in its entirety now on FX on Hulu, Nick leaves his comedic persona behind to take on the deadly serious role of Forrest, the enigmatic founder of a dystopian tech company called Amaya. As Nick explains in this episode, it was his enormous, deep-set eyes that first convinced creator Alex Garland that he could play a man who seems simultaneously evil and wholly sympathetic. The show can be majorly disturbing, and Nick is fantastic on it. Nick and I went deep on Devs with pretty minimal spoilers, but if you're not caught up, what are you waiting for? Of course, we also spent a good amount of time talking about last month's Parks and Rec reunion special, which I still think is the most successful piece of quarantine content yet. Before we get to our conversation, if you're enjoying this show, please let us know by leaving a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. If you have ideas for guests you want to hear on the show or questions you want me to ask comedians, they just might end up on a future episode. You can also go to ratethispodcast.com/laugh to rate this podcast wherever you listen. Okay, this is me and Nick Offerman.
Okay, that's recording. Let's get a little higher level. Check, check, pow. Hilarious, Dev, sci-fi, Alex Garland, Allison Pill, cold as ice. All right.
Thanks for doing this. You have a very professional setup at home because you've been doing a lot of stuff from home these past couple of months, huh?
Yeah. Specifically, Megan and I have been recording episodes of our own podcast from home. And so we got this recorder and nice microphones. But then, you know, once we were merely days into the lockdown, mm-hmm. You know, I it's so funny. People, I keep reading about people like getting to learn how to cook osobuco and yeah. bake and, you know, make pasta from scratch and have all of this downtime they need to fill. And I guess it's a blessing. I have yet to experience anything but a more busy schedule than when we're not in quarantine.
It did occur to me that your podcast in bed was perhaps the worst suited for this time that we're in, where you were previously getting in bed with strangers, which now you're really not supposed to do that anymore, I don't think.
No, from what I understand. if you want to do that, you have to travel to Florida or Georgia, apparently.
Right, right. Did you consider moving the podcast to Florida or Georgia?
We did not. We did not, because we're not assholes.
But you've been getting virtually in bed with your guests now.
And yes, that's exactly what we say is virtually and figuratively, spiritually in bed.
Well, I really want to talk about Devs, which I have to say is one of my favorite shows that's come out during this time. And it's the thing that I recommend to everyone who's like, you know, what should I be watching right now? But before
Thank
we
you.
Do that, I do want to ask a couple questions about the Parks and Rec reunion, which was so much fun. And, you know, it was just a little bit ago when we're talking now. The joke in the show is that Ron Swanson is like perfectly suited to this because he's been social distancing since he was 4 years old. But how are you coping with this time? Better or worse than Ron, would you say?
I guess probably not as good as Ron because I am a social animal. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't have a cabin that's accessible, you know?
Yeah.
If I had a cabin I could go to where I could like hunt and dress deer and like, you know, be packing away meat for the future and he's drying out, he's making jerky and whatnot. That's the only thing that's driving me crazy. Like the upside to this for those of us that have the good fortune to simply be inconvenienced, you know, I'm not a frontline first responder. I don't work in a hospital. I don't work in a grocery store. My job is to stay home and try to figure out where we can donate money or like help the people that still have to run the world. So the main problem, you know, the upside of it is we get to enjoy these beautiful homes or whatever situation, whatever domestic nest we've created. We never have the time to slow down and say, you know what, let's just stay home for a couple weeks and like explore what we have in our pantry and so forth. And so that, you know, that is a nice silver lining to this crazy, strange and tragic time that we're living through. The problem is for me, I just need to be productive.
Yeah.
I love getting good work done, and luckily I can be acting, I can be writing, I can be working in my wood shop, or I can be like touring and entertaining people. One way or another, I need to be making something. Mm-hmm. I am going to my wood shop, which is across Los Angeles, so it's not particularly convenient, and it feels since I don't, it's not essential that I go there and make things.
Mm-hmm.
It feels a little bit like an ass wipe, you know, if I go there every day because I'm needy.
Yeah.
Is that
where you shot the scenes for Parks and Rec? Was in the wood shop?
It is, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
My wood shop over the years always, Ron Swanson's wood shop was shot at my wood shop with some set dressing.
Yeah. You were well set up to do that because you had access to the wood shop and you had, you were the only person who got to appear with another human in frame, I believe.
That's right.
With your wife as Tammy too.
That was very gratifying. And it's always fun. There's always on social media, even now, there's always new audience members who say they freak out and say, oh my God, why are those two people together? And then they discover that we're married and it blows their minds.
Yeah. That was pretty great. That scene, but how did the whole thing kind of work? Because were you actually able to act off of everyone or are you kind of shooting your stuff, a lot of it on your own or how did it actually function?
It was by and large, when you think about it, And I'm fascinated, by the way, we are fans of American Idol, among other shows, and we've been watching the live episodes they're doing, and also the incredible live episodes that Saturday Night Live has been doing. And we're fascinated with the strategy, the logistics of it, because Megan and I both participate in different musical endeavors, and so we're aware that you can't have the four Rolling Stones on a Zoom call and play a song together because of the delay.
Yeah.
It's impossible to play together.
That's what I was thinking when they did that for the that benefit.
Exactly. So I believe, and I'm talking, you know, slightly out my ass, but I believe anything you see like that has been shot and produced together.
Yeah.
So like American Idol, for example, they do an incredible job of making it feel live and like, here's the judges and here's this contestant in Shreveport. And it's like, they had to shoot this and like somebody had to knit this all together. So for Parks and Rec, Morgan Sackett was always our, like Mike Schur is the main creator, the main brain and heart of the show. Morgan Sackett, if Mike built the beautiful yacht Morgan Sackett. And let me switch that metaphor. Morgan Sackett builds and supplies the yacht so that Mike can freely drive it as creatively as possible. So Morgan Sackett is this incredible producer and director who kind of the unsung hero of not only Parks and Rec, but The Good Place and Veep. He's incredible. And this was his brainchild, was like, if the strategy of getting all those cast members camera packages and talking them through setting up their shots through like Zoom calls and FaceTime. So like in my wood shop, for example, Megan and I set up the shots, but we had, so we're shooting on an iPhone, but then we had Morgan and Dean Holland and Mike Schur on Zoom. So they're, and I'm actually showing them the shot with like my laptop.
So, so we can kind of direct it from afar.
Yeah, we're all making sure that, that it's going to work. And then there's, I mean, there may, I don't know if there would be a way to actually achieve it, but there, to my knowledge, it was, it would be impossible to do all the scenes together. I mean, you could arguably have the actor, you know, I could have Amy on a FaceTime call or something, but that would require yet another channel of communication. Just to read the lines.
Yeah. So you're basically just doing your lines in isolation and they're stitching it all together afterwards.
Yes. Yeah. Which, which when you go back and look at it is pretty goddamn amazing.
Yeah. Like it, you wouldn't know from watching it at all.
No, it's one of the many examples of like, I'm glad I always liken myself. If this is an army, I'm a guy with a shovel and I love all these specialists and General Mike Schur and his incredible lieutenants at some point tell me what to shovel and where. And the hilarious thing is then the audience says, God, that guy with the shovel was amazing. I say, well, all I did was dig. Like somebody had to figure everything else out.
Hello, Leslie. I see you are contacting me again.
This is the system, Ron. 7 p.m. phone tree. I call someone and then they call someone else and we keep doing it until everyone has been reached. This is the system. You got a better system?
Yes, we talk far less than that. Or we just send each other a photo of ourselves holding up today's newspaper to prove we're okay.
It's impossible to get everyone on the phone at the same time, you know? And talking is important, Ron. We have to look out for our mental and emotional health.
This is the only mental health I need.
What are you doing? Are you in your cabin?
I am. I come up here to hunt meat so I don't have to go to the grocery store. I've built up about a 12-year supply of venison jerky. I can ship you some. You probably have to get your incisor teeth sharpened.
Ew, no. When you travel, are you practicing social distancing?
I've been practicing social distancing since I was 4 years old.
I imagine the hardest sequence to pull off then was the song at the end, the little Sebastian song. Was that, so you were all, again, doing that, all of your own parts separately?
Yeah, totally. And listening to, you know, we're all singing along to a track. And so that allows it to match up. But yeah, I mean, it's once again, I had the opportunity to just be so grateful to be part of this team of collaborators.
Yeah, I thought I maybe saw you tearing up a little bit during the song. Is that emotional for you to do that?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I tour as a humorist among other jobs that I do, and almost right away, I never thought I would turn out to be a comedian, as it were. I'm a theater actor by training. But early on in Parks and Rec, probably a few years in, so probably I think 2011 or so, maybe 12, colleges began to invite me to perform my stand-up. And I said, oh, I don't do that. I'm a theater actor.
Yeah.
But eventually, it pays really well, and I thought, how many kids? 2,000 kids? Yeah, I would really love to talk to 2,000 college students. Please tell Ohio State that, yes, I will come perform my stand-up. So I started writing specials. Actually, this timing is good. Literally tomorrow, I think, I'm on the cusp of releasing a website, nickofferman.co. Oh, cool. And I'm, for the first time, I'm releasing my specials
for
availability. Yeah. And because of the timing, I'm donating all the proceeds to food charities.
That's great.
Well, you know, my rent is paid, so I'd be kind of a douche if I didn't do that. But so I started performing as a humorist, and it was like my third or fourth college was University of Wisconsin at Madison, one of the greatest schools in the country. I love it. When you walk off stage, you get handed a very large beer and a bratwurst. And I was doing a Q&A after the show, and somehow Lil Sebastian came up, and the place went crazy. The roof blew off the joint. And so I sang a little bit of it, and everybody just went wild. So I got a hold of Mike Schur, and I said, hey, when I'm out here touring, I play songs on the guitar. Does anybody care if, like, for an encore or something, if I do 5,000 Candles in the Wind? And he said, no, you know, go nuts. And so I started doing that. And so now for years, that's part of my encore, is I do 5,000 Candles in the Wind. And the audience just goes bananas. They all wave their lighters or they light up their phones and wave them. And, you know, it's so that song has remained a very vital part of my life. You know, it's never gone away for me. And it is so meaningful. It makes me think about Chris Pratt, and that makes me tear up. Makes me think about the way Ron feels about Lil Sebastian or felt about him. That not only does that make Ron tear up, but the fact that they wrote that for me, that makes me tear up. Like the whole, it's just layers on layers of gratitude and emotion. And that's why it was the finale of the episode. And that's, you know, from the social media that I saw, that's what got the most play. Everyone said, thank you so much. Especially thank you so much for 5,000 Candles in the Wind. Like,
I thought the whole show was just so affecting. And that was really just the capper at the end. And it really, it just worked so well. It's one of, I mean, Even more so than SNL and all these people are doing things from home, I felt like this Parks and Rec special is sort of the most successful example of what you can do from home in this way, which is, it's really challenging. And it's, you know, it seems like we're going to be doing it for longer than we expected. So it's important to figure these things out.
I agree. And once again, you know, Mike Schur, Morgan Sackett, Doug Smith, Dean Holland, these brains and the writers, we had like seven of our writers. They're the most clever people, you know, and part of their cleverness is they can walk through the airport. They pick a shoveler like me, and I have to take the hit. I get all the credit, but I also can't stand in line at the Shake Shack without being accosted.
Well, fortunately, no one's standing in line at Shake Shack anymore. So
yes, for better or worse.
So let's talk about Devs, which, as I said, is just a phenomenal show. And I think you're so, so wonderful in it. And it is kind of like going back to your dramatic roots, right?
Very much. I started professionally in Chicago theater in the mid 90s. And, you know, in the theater, you play whatever is on the season. And so you have, I guess, a more generalized toolbox than a specialist like the comedy people who I'm often associated with, who trained at the Upright Citizens Brigade or Second City or, you know, the Groundlings. Those, you know, they are trained in improvisation and sketch comedy and maybe impersonations, things like that. Mm-hmm. Whereas I got to be ready to do Shakespeare or Sam Shepard or, you know, Martin McDonough or, you know, Carol Churchill, Sarah Rule, whatever's on the season, or the most broad, like Fado farce or Joe Orton comedies, you know? And so I've always loved making people laugh, but I feel like my years in Chicago, I was more known as like a villain that people love to hate. That was kind of my favorite thing to do, was to play a dastardly villain, but just relish in having the audience laugh, being able to make them laugh or charm them like Gene Hackman as Lex Luthor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, your character Forrest on in Devs is definitely villainous in some ways, but also very sympathetic in other ways. So what were your sort of impressions of this character when it first came to you?
Well, I mean, you know, in a nutshell, I was at my wood shop one day and I got a call that Alex Garland wanted to meet with me about a new show he was doing. And I welled up. That's, you know, I've had a wonderful run of good fortune in my life, but still getting that phone call was a big surprise. You know, I would not have thought I would ever be on Alex's radar. Mainly being such a huge fan of Ex Machina and Annihilation. And so one of the many anomalous things about the gorgeous, exquisite genius of Alex Garland is his commonsensical practicality. So he exists outside of the commerce and the metabolism of show business in such a gorgeous way. So, for example, it would never occur to him to begin shooting an 8-episode series without having written the whole thing.
Yeah.
As opposed to so much of the TV business where you sell a pilot based on a cocktail napkin pitch.
And then you have to figure something out.
They're like, oh shit, they bought it. Now what, yeah, what are we going to do with, you know, Don Draper or whoever? Yeah. Oh no. And, you know, and I said that to him, you know, and he just shook his head and said, well, doesn't that seem crazy to like start a painting, not knowing what colors you're going to end up with, or like, you know, what the end of how long the canvas is.
It's almost like he wanted everything to be predetermined.
Exactly. And so going in, we got to read all 8 scripts. And I mean, so there's no, you know, I've been asked this question, like, what was it about the character? I don't care. I would have played any goddamn part in that show. Like,
did he tell you what it was about you that made him want you to play the character?
He did eventually. He said that, and I don't know, you know, how much I agree with him, but he said that he felt like you sort of hit on it. Forrest does some pretty despicable things, especially from the outset. Before you know what's going on in the narrative, the morality seems very questionable on the part of Forrest. But then as you begin to learn his motives and sort of the justifications that he makes to himself and others for his actions, it becomes much more of a gray area where you're like, well, it makes sense. I don't know if it makes it okay, but at least at least I see what's going on with him. And so he said, in order for Forrest to work, in order for the series to work, the audience really needed to have empathy for Forrest. And he felt like, you know, because I have these abnormally large eyeballs, that there's a lot of acreage below my eyebrows. He said that he felt like I could elicit empathy, and that he was not familiar with Parks and Recreation, I eventually learned, which is pretty satisfying. And he also didn't really know a lot about me. He had seen some of the work I'm the most proud of, but like that nobody knows about, which is mainly movies that have premiered at Sundance, and then like, you know, had like a small art house release, and people, you know, the popular culture audience just doesn't always get to those.
The first time we see Forrest is when he's shoveling that salad into his mouth, which I think also became kind of a talked about moment on the show. Was that something that you came up with on the spot, or where did that come from?
It was. Alex and I, in the script, it was something like Forrest, you know, as Forrest like hustles in with Katie to this meeting, he's finishing the last bites of a Danish, I think, was in the script. And so we're blocking the scene, and I said, you know, let's talk about this Danish. Like, I'm going to be chewing. which on one hand, what I like about what the action conveys is this guy, you know, is unkempt. Like, he's not, meticulous. He didn't have a nice tidy breakfast somewhere. He's just like, hey, grab me a Danish that I'll wolf down in the hallway on my way to my first meeting. And we just said, Alex said, like, oh yeah, you're right. I like that. I like the practicality of not having a cumbersome like mouthful of dough for you know whatever 17 takes of this scene. And so we tossed it back and forth, and there was a lot of stuff like this, and Alex is really generous about it. I mean, I usually it was between the two of us we came up with it. I believe it was my idea to eat it with my hands, because I love to do that myself. Like when I'm fishing with my family and I'm like in a cabin by myself, I just get a big bag of spinach and you know, why go to the trouble of making a salad? Just like shove down two handfuls there. You've been healthy, and it took 30 seconds.
Coming up, Nick talks about how quarantine has changed his priorities and reveals the two people that make him laugh the hardest. Hint, he's married to one of them.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
This episode of The Last Laugh is brought to you by Vanderpump Villa, a new reality show starring Lisa Vanderpump, now streaming only on Hulu. Join Lisa and her hand-selected staff at Chateau Rosabel, a glamorous estate in the French countryside. Meet the elite staff as they work, live, and play together 24/7 while dealing with rivalry, romance, and misadventures. As they try to provide once-in-a-lifetime experiences for their guests, the staff will need to meet Lisa's high standards. Not everybody has what it takes. Watch new episodes of Vanderpump Villa every Monday, now on Hulu.
Do you feel like this time of, you know, of quarantine and all that has changed your priorities or the things that you want to accomplish? I know you're also you're turning 50 soon, so that's also a big milestone. Do you think about those sort of like what you want to do next, what you want to accomplish?
I suppose it's brought those things into focus. For some reason, unbeknownst to me, I have an incredible family, and I grew up with a wonderful set of parents, and I have three siblings that are incredible, like wonderfully redoubtable citizens. My mom and dad just did a hell of a good job. You know, we're all humans. We all have our flaws, but like we all are conscientious citizens. We're all doing our best to like promote good manners and neighborly love, and you know, to create more than we destroy, to leave things nicer than we found them, to do unto those downstream as we would have those upstream of us do unto us, which is butchering a Wendell Berry quote. And so the older I get, the more, you know, it's funny. I feel the cliche of it even when conversing with myself, but it's the simple things. The older I get, the more I love my family, the more I just want to spend time with them. The less I want to consume anything, you know, I've lost any desire to ever go shopping for anything. I'm like, do my shoes work? Great.
Yeah.
When they quit working, I'll get another pair of shoes. Like,
yeah.
And so, you know, as I grow older, I focus on my health, my relationship with Megan and our lives together and my family. I have this disposition where, and it's served me so well in this stupid, gross business. And that is, I've never been terribly ambitious. I love getting to like perform good writing for people, whether it's funny or it gives them a catharsis of one sort or another. And I got to work as an actor professionally, you know, when I met Megan, I was about to turn 30, and I had been working for about 7 years. And like when I was merely an unknown character actor, Mr. Megan Mullally, and working as a carpenter and an aspiring woodworker, I thought I had made it beyond my wildest dreams. Mm-hmm. I was like, holy cow, this life has turned out amazingly. And then I got like a series on Comedy Central called American Body Shop. And then, you know, I got a handful of things that sort of built up. And then I got in my mid to late 30s, I think I was 38 when I got Ron Swanson. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, life was like, oh, by the way, things are going to get way more super crazy.
Yeah.
And that's been the story for 11 or 12 years now. And the thing is, I'm like, well, now I've definitely...
Now you're really set.
Yeah, I mean, I've gotten to do things beyond my wildest dreams. And so that allows me to not be ambitious. I don't call my agents and say, what are you doing? You know, why am I not the next Batman or whatever?
Well, you wait for Alex Garland to call you, so that's pretty good.
Well, the thing is, I just always have a policy of following my gut. Mm-hmm. Like, if something comes my way... Then I consider it. I try to work on good writing with people that I enjoy. Those are the two rules.
Yeah.
Is this good writing? Does it inspire me? Like, do I think this is moving some conversation forward, or is it just like, or is this just like, oh, it's a good gig? And I'm lucky enough. It's so incredibly lucky as an actor to be able to pick what you do.
Mm-hmm.
And when those good gigs come along, say, eh. It's just a good gig. Like, I'd rather go work, build things at my shop or write a book in case Alex Garland is going to call.
Yeah. Well, with that in mind, I do want to look back at a couple of your earlier gigs to see if there's a story or memory that comes to mind from those experiences. And starting with what I think I found is your first TV appearance was on ER.
ER was a mind-blowing sort of first, like, guest star job.
That was a big deal.
Yeah, I had only been in Los Angeles for, I don't know, 6 months maybe. And here's the thing. It was the first live episode of ER. I think it was a season.
That was a big deal too. I remember that.
Premiere or a season finale. And George Clooney was still on the show.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was so exciting. I was so excited. I don't know if anybody, I know I was the first person to ever actually light a joint in Dr. Green, Anthony Edwards, ER. And Maria Bello said, hey man, you can't fire that thing up in here. and the thing was, they rehearsed it like a play. So they threw the elephant doors open of the sound stage.
Yeah.
And all day long, there were like all of these stage managers dressed as nurses and doctors, because the whole thing would play out because it was live.
Mm-hmm.
So somebody would walk by you and say, okay, like, open the door now. So everything was choreographed.
Yeah. Well, that's so much pressure for a young actor who hasn't been on TV a lot.
Yeah, it was, but it was so easy and like spoon fed. There was, there was no risk. Like, there was a couple stunts in the show and you know, those always have like somebody fell off a building or something, but, for being a theater actor, and I used to do a lot of stage combat and sword fighting. So to have like five lines and have somebody be like, okay, go. And you're like, okay, here's my lines. Okay. I've rehearsed this 30 times. Okay. And that's it. It's over. But it was so thrilling. And the best thing about it was hanging with George Clooney. They had this table set up backstage with a huge pot of soup. Mm. And he said it felt very maritime, which it did. It was chilly out. and there was like a breeze because the doors were open and we're standing around eating soup. And so he and I would sway back and forth singing The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. And then a crazy aside, probably 5 years later, I saw him at an Oscar party. Mm-hmm. I hadn't seen him since. And we never really met. Like, we just had soup together. Mm-hmm. And he famously always remembers everybody. Like, it's one of the things that makes a great politician or a mm-hmm. movie star. I run into him at an Oscar party at Brian Lord's house, and Megan and I were making a beeline for Patricia Clarkson, who we were just besotted with, who could
you
have
ended
ever
up working
met.
With later, right?
On
Parks and Rec.
Those were my two ex-wives right there. I mean, what a lucky son of a bitch. But we run into George Clooney, and he says, like, hi to Megan, and he looks at me and points and says, Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. And I was like, wow. do I blow you now? Like, how does this work? I could not believe that recall. But yeah, that was incredibly fun.
Yeah. One of your earliest or first recurring roles, I believe, was on 24. Was that experience similarly intense,
it was very intense. It was really fun in a lot of ways because it's funny. Like, I choreographed a lot of sword fights, but also a lot of like hand to hand combat on stage in Chicago. Then when you get to LA, I immediately was told, okay, buddy, you can either be a stuntman or an actor. Mm-hmm. But if they do like the Three Musketeers or Pirates movies or whatever, they're not looking at people's resumes to see mm-hmm. who is a great sword fighter from Chicago. Like, they want Orlando Bloom, and with good reason. And they're like, okay, maybe he's a great sword fighter, or if he's not, we'll figure it out. Either we'll teach him or we'll cut around it. And so I always, to this day, I'm like, man, it's something I just wish I got to do more of. I was much more athletic than I was talented at acting. So I'm like, sort of my greatest strength. Mm-hmm. I've never gotten to do that much. But working on 24 involved a bunch of cool action stuff. So that part was very satisfying. At the same time, the show had a mercenary feel that taught me that I didn't really want to work on that kind of genre. One of the directors I worked with was kind of misogynist. He sort of took me aside. There was a part where I had to terrorize a woman mm-hmm. physically, like at a door, like kind of rough her up and scare her. Yeah. And the director, he was an old fashioned director. He took me aside and was like, you know, why don't you go ahead and be a little rough, like really scared, like really be brutal to this actress.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, that's the first thing you are taught as a stage choreographer and stage combatant is obviously it's fucking safety first. Like mm-hmm. you're throwing swords around or punches or whatever. And often if you're filming it, if it's on stage, you got to do it every night, 8 times a week. Or if you're doing it on 24, you have to do it for 12 takes or whatever. So the most important thing is that everyone feels safe. And here this, and it's that old fashioned thing of like, hey, you know what? Just punch him.
Yeah.
which is just stupid and old fashioned and misogynist. So I said, of course, no, I'm not going to do that. And I told her that mm-hmm. he told
did
me that.
That he wanted you to?
And I was like, look, let's just work this out. And there's all these ways, you know, people have been doing this for decades. Like mm-hmm. there's many ways to convincingly, it's called acting.
Yeah.
You can act out a scene where you're brutal to another person without actually having to like squeeze their arm too hard. Mm-hmm. So that was upsetting. And, you know, so there's things like that where you're like, oh, wow, stuff like that does exist in this business.
Mm-hmm.
I'm always fascinated by people's experiences on Curb Your Enthusiasm, which you were fortunate enough to guest star on not too long ago. What was that? What was that experience like? Because that's such a unique setup at that show in terms of the improv and how it
works. It is. Yeah, I mean, I love that show so much, and I think it's been on. I don't know. Hasn't it been going for 20 years?
Yeah,
or something?
20 years, I think.
I mean, so I've been crazy about it the whole time. Now, Jeff Garlin, who plays Larry's agent on the show, named Jeff, I believe, Garlin.
Green.
Jeff Green, thank you. And so in real life, 27 years ago, Jeff Garlin's wife at the time, Marla Garlin, was my first agent in Chicago.
Oh, wow.
And so somehow through that, I had like run into them a couple times. Somehow she and Jeff thought highly of me in a way that over the years I had auditioned at least 4 or 5 times for Curb.
Oh, really?
And the crazy thing is, you go in and audition, you improvise with whoever your scene is with. Mm-hmm. So in the room, you got Larry and Jeff are always there because they're the executive producers, but you got Cheryl Hines or whoever else.
Mm-hmm.
And so out of nowhere, you get a call and you got to go in and improvise a scene with Larry David and usually they were with Larry. And because usually he's the one, you know, being an asshole, mm-hmm. whoever the new victim is. And so I had been through these things and they were so fun and exciting. And these people were so generous. I never got the job, obviously.
Yeah.
But every time they would say, like, you're really funny. That was really great. Like, they made me feel so comfortable and never got it. And it was always like, meh, you know, you'd kind of see who did get it. And you're like, yeah, that makes sense. You know, it was never like I totally bit the dust. And then finally, gratifyingly, I just get a call 18 years into this where they're like, hey, will you come do this part?
No audition.
Play the stage manager for Lin-Manuel has written a musical,
yeah.
Yeah, starring F. Murray Abraham. and of course I was like, oh my God. So that was actually where I got to meet Lin.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so fun. It was so fun to do. But it was really weird. Actually doing a couple scenes with Larry was really weird.
Yeah.
Because he obviously is just such a comic genius and he's so funny and he's so specific. You sort of realize that he's funny despite, and I don't even mean this to disparage him, but he's not a very good actor. Yeah. Like
I don't think he would say he's a very good actor, probably.
Yeah, I mean, he's kind of like a vaudevillian or something where he's like playing this character.
Yeah.
And so it's incredibly effective. Obviously, it's great. We're like, whatever he's doing, don't fix it. But to suddenly be in a scene with him was like, oh, you're not a good, like, give take. Like, yeah. You haven't had acting class.
It's a different kind of thing.
It really is. And it was, you know, so there was a brief moment of like, oh, this is weird. Okay. I got it. And he's like, suddenly you realize that like what you see him doing sometimes where he has like difficulty pronouncing words and gesticulating, it's because it's all he can do to like, you know, get through the scene. And then you realize, oh, right. The thing to do is like, bend your knees and play defense and get ready to catch Larry in case he falls in one direction or the other. It was just so fun. It felt like you were in a scene with like Bugs Bunny or something where you're like, oh my God, this man has made me laugh so many times.
Yeah.
And now I just have to keep my shit together.
So you've obviously worked with so many funny people over the years, and we end these interviews by asking, is there a comedian who has made you laugh the hardest? Maybe someone that you've worked with on set, or even someone that you've seen perform. When you think of just who in your life has made you laugh the hardest, who comes to mind?
Well, I am. I'm afraid I'm going to have to be greedy and there's two answers to this question.
That's okay.
The first is Chris Pratt. I knew Chris for some years before Parks and Rec started. I met him at a pool party at Justin Long's house at some point. And I had not seen, I think he had done Everwood and like the OC or something, which I had not seen. So I hadn't met him, didn't know who he was. And I just, and got to talking to him and just thought, good God. And I said to him, I think this happened to him a lot. I said, if you're not a movie star yet, you are by God going to be. Like he is, and it hasn't really been showing up in his current chapter, which is the Guardians and Jurassic Park sort of chapter with other movies thrown in. But like, which are their own thing, and certainly Guardians has really funny moments in it, but like nothing touches on or perhaps allows him to shine the way that Parks and Rec did.
Yeah, watching him in the special, the reunion, really made me want to see him do more comedy because he was so funny in that show.
He is. I mean, it's not fair. He's also because he's made such a wonderful career of like before becoming an A-list movie star, of being like a doofus, you know, a lovable doofus. It's sort of a persona that he honed, kind of similarly in some ways to the way Conan comes off as like, I'm just a gawky nerd. Like I'm a harmless clown. And then when you hang with him in real life, you're like, oh, you're like a Nordic god. He's like a Viking. I've gone bike riding with Conan, and Chris is the same way, where he's like a bumbling, you know, idiot. That guy, when we would work on Parks and Rec, he would come in to my trailer in the morning, you know, getting our coffee, like before we go in to start the day. And he would like tell me an idea for a TV series that he had on the way into work. And 7 minutes into the description, I would say, hang on, have you told your agents this idea? And this happened 24 times.
Yeah.
Every single idea was absolutely genius. Like Chris is as smart as anybody I've ever met, but he cloaks it in that doofus thing. And in the same way, improvising on Parks and Rec, I knew, I've said this before, but like for each cast member, I sort of had a shield that I could for Aubrey or Amy or Adam Scott, like I knew where to place my shield to withstand the laser blasts of their particular brand of comedy.
Yeah.
Pratt would come like through the fucking sewer up through left field and just always sneak in and so that would break me so hard.
Yeah.
Because first was the inkling, the realization that, God damn it, you got in and got me. And then I would just like giggle with laughter. But the person who makes me laugh the hardest for 20 years now is my wife, Megan Mullally. She is the most wickedly funny person. And obviously, look, you know, if I look at her closet full of trophies, I'm not the only one who thinks this.
Yeah.
But being married to her and then especially getting to work with her in comedy, it's incredibly delicious and like, I mean, it's like the rush of, I've never injected drugs, but it's
you imagine that's what it feels like?
The description of like a narcotic rush of like, oh my God, like you've filled me with such an opiatic pleasure. And she can do it because, again, she knows my buttons and she knows how to push them. If we're in a scene together and we just make eye contact, I'm done. Like she can just do something like, there's a scene in Parks and Rec where she slaps a piece of beef jerky against her face and I'm gone. I'm just like on the floor. She can, with just a look or a gesture, or she can even just, like, there's one scene where she just brushes against me. I'm a giggling, sobbing mess.
Well, I'm glad that you have each other to entertain each other from home during this time.
We're pretty lucky.
Thank you so much, Nick. This was really a treat, and it was great to talk to you, and good luck with everything.
Thank you very much, Matt, and it's a pleasure talking with you, and thanks for being gentle with me.
Okay. All right. Have a good one.
You too. Stay safe.
You too. Bye.
Bye.
Maybe someday we'll saddle up again. No, I'll always miss my horse's friend. Spread your wings and fly. Spread your wings and fly.
Oh man, thank you so much to Nick Offerman for that great conversation. You can stream all 8 episodes of Devs on FX on Hulu right now. His podcast, In Bed with Nick and Megan, is available wherever you get your podcasts. Nick has 3 live comedy specials that are all available to stream or download on his website, nickofferman.co, with proceeds going to America's Food Fund. And if for some crazy reason you haven't watched the Parks and Rec reunion special yet, that's on Hulu as well. If you like this show, please tell your friends and rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. And if you're not already, please follow at Last Laugh Pod on Instagram. I'll share a photo there of Nick's excellent Zoom background. The Last Laugh is distributed by Acast for The Daily Beast, with audio production by Red Rock Music. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find this show every week on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.